I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, the seven leading Republican presidential candidates met in Charleston, South Carolina, for their sixth debate hosted by Fox Business less than 3 weeks before the Iowa caucuses. While they were asked about a range of policy issues, including jobs, the economy, tariffs, refugees, immigration, ISIS, Iran, the two leading candidates, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, got into some heated and personal arguments. Senator Cruz was asked about his citizenship and his legitimacy as a presidential candidate, something that Trump has raised in the last week. Cruz was born in Canada.
Back in September, my friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way. And there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, since September, the Constitution hasn't changed. But the poll numbers have. And I recognize that Donald is dismayed that his poll numbers are falling in Iowa. But the facts and the law here are really quite clear. Under longstanding U.S. law, the child of a U.S. citizen born abroad is a natural-born citizen. If a soldier has a child abroad, that child is a natural-born citizen. That's why John McCain, even though he was born in Panama, was eligible to run for president. If an American missionary has a child abroad, that child is a natural-born citizen. That's why George Romney, Mitt's dad, was eligible to run for president, even though he was born in Mexico.
Trump responded that Cruz's birthplace could be an issue for the Democrats.
I already know the Democrats are going to be bringing a suit. You have a big lawsuit over your head while you're running, and if you become the nominee, who the hell knows if you can even serve in office? So you should go out, get a declaratory judgment, let the courts decide, and you shouldn't have mentioned the polls because I would have been much different.
Why now? Why are you raising this issue now?
Because now he's doing a little bit better. No, I didn't care before. It's true.
Well, today, what was said last night and what that says about the candidates and the Republican Party. We have three guests who have joined us. Joining us by telephone is Alan Novak. He's an attorney, former chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, and he currently serves as the president of Novak Strategic Advisors. That's a consulting firm. And Alan Novak, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. It's great to be back with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. Also joining us by telephone is Ben Domenech, publisher of The Federalist, also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ben, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
And also with us, in fact, here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Joe Watkins. He's a political commentator, a regular contributor for MSNBC. He served in the first Bush White House. He was part of Dan Quayle's Senate staff. He's the pastor of the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church and senior vice president for ElectedFace.com. And Joe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. So where do we start? And let me put this to you, Alan Novak. As former chair of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, what does last night's debate say about the Republican Party?
Well, I think it says more about the candidates running for office right now. I see it as a moment that probably to other candidates' dismay, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz dominated in that that's who's being discussed today. When I look at a debate, there's a couple of things. You're trying to give your supporters reason to stay energized and continue to support you. You're trying to dominate a news cycle. You're trying to win over some undecided voters. And frankly, I don't see anything to change the dynamic of where the race stands at this moment coming out of last night's debate, other than Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are continuing to be the two names mentioned all day today and probably all throughout the weekend.
Let me turn to you, Joe, and put the same question. What does it say, though, about the Republican Party? And I was wondering if, you know, an alien landed and this was their introduction to American politics and they sat in front of a TV set last night. What would they think about the Republican Party?
Well, I guess it would show the changing landscape of the party. I've said repeatedly that in order for the party, I think, going forward to be viable as a national party. It has to be able to reach out to lots of Americans. It's got to be a party that certainly does better than it did in 2012 and 2008 in the Electoral College in terms of reaching Americans, and that the tent has to be bigger. It's got to be a much bigger tent than it currently is. Now, that being said, you've got a lot of angry Americans, both on the left and on the right, people who are dissatisfied with the economy and with immigration and with the state of terror in the world. And so you've got the candidates who best talk to those issues really resonating most with the voters. And so Donald Trump said it very plain last night. He said, I am angry.
Yes, he did.
He said, I'm angry. And that's because he knows that the polling data shows that there are a lot of angry voters out there.
Ben, what was your takeaway from last night's debate?
My takeaway is that this is a party that is much more responsive to the priorities of, I think, it's a disaffected and angry core of independent and nonpartisan voters this cycle, who, really are frustrated with the situation of things. Contrast the type of situation that you saw in this debate to the State of the Union the other night, and you see a situation where the president really was kind of just whistling past the graveyard, pretending that things were okay, pretending that this economy was satisfactory, pretending that the state of affairs in terms of respect around the world was okay. And you see a Democratic Party that I think has really lost touch with the state of affairs in the country at large. I think this is a Republican Party that has at least two candidates, and maybe more, who are very responsive to that kind of anger and who actually want to offer a response to it in a significant way. And I think that that's a good thing to be in terms of a party that's going to be challenging the status quo, one that's going to be making the case for change through the election season this fall.
Picking up on what you just said there, Ben, I mean, it sounds like President Bush sounded more like Ronald Reagan about, mourning in America compared to some of these Republicans. And what you get from the Republicans is that we are a weak country. We're disrespected around the world. We are in decline. We're a stupid country. That would be quoting Donald Trump. Is that America today, do you think?
I think it actually is. In a sense that, the candidate who a lot of people have expected to take off this cycle in the Republican elite, in the establishment, is Marco Rubio. And he has certainly a message that is that seems like more of the kind of palatable general election message that you might expect, one that's optimistic, one that is kind of a sunny side of America. I think this might be more of a dark man for dark times kind of election, though. It might be a situation where the kind of apocalyptic opinions of America at large are winning out over the course of this election in a way that they haven't previously. And I think that, frankly, this is an American situation right now where there is more pessimism about our establishment, about our elite, about institutions, about the sort of respect that people have for our government and for what's going on within that context than we've seen it previously in many decades. I mean, we're at historical lows in terms of the level of optimism that we've seen. And while that may be something that's kind of pessimistic in the context, I think it's also something that Republicans see accrue to their benefit in the context of an election where Hillary Clinton is basically going to be making the case for continuing the status quo, for keeping things going the way that they are. And I think that's going to be very difficult for her in this context.
Joe, is that a message that you think resonates with Republicans? We're obviously talking about the Republican Party and whoever is attracted to the party.
Yeah, well, I think that given the times, you've got to consider that if you look at both the left and the right, I mean, Bernie Sanders has been a lot stronger on the left than anybody supposed that he would be. I mean, initially when he announced his bid for the presidency, nobody thought that he would have any kind of staying power. And instead, here it is, in the weeks before Iowa, he's only a scant, 7 or 8 points behind Hillary Clinton with a lot less money, but certainly capitalizing again, even on the left, the anger and the disappointment that so many Americans have with what's happening right now in Washington. And so for candidates in both the left and the right who were able to do that, tap into that that anger, that disgust, the fact that we're not able to get anything done, that we've got all these huge problems and nothing's being done about it. We're told the economy is is okay, but you know, the labor force participation rate is only 62.6%, and there are the long term unemployment rate is 25.7%. I mean, these are things that explain the anger of so many Americans, whether they're Republican or Democrat.
Going to you, Alan, and clearly whatever Donald Trump is doing is good for his brand. Do you think it's good for the GOP brand, how Donald Trump talks about issues, how he frankly treats other candidates, people that he shares the stage with? He calls them names. He calls them out. Is that good? Is that good for the Republican Party?
Well, I think that's all yet to be determined. I believe that I want to go back to Ben's point. I think there is, I don't know about the word anger. There's some people that are angry. I think there's a lack of confidence. There's a lack of trust. And I don't think it's a lack of confidence in America. I think there's a lack of confidence and trust in the management of America, in the effectiveness of our government, in the effectiveness of our institutions, and a lack of confidence that the people that are leading the country are effective and leading it in the right direction. Donald Trump is a media master, and he is playing a game that is a new game. This isn't a party anymore where a few people get in a room and make a decision that this is the candidate X or Y are going to be the candidates for president and vice president. Let's get behind them and get them elected. This is probably, the Republican Party is probably more connected to the people than ever before. And frankly, I think it's independent voters along with an energized base of voters that wins a general election. I think Donald Trump's probably doing a pretty good job of reaching independent voters right now. And he's connecting in ways that, come across as frank discussion. I'm not saying I agree with his methods. My style of speaking and my style of connecting is a little different than his.
Sounds that way.
But
I haven't heard you call anyone names yet, Alan.
But, it's a down and, it's a rough and tumble style, which is kind of an American tradition. I was appalled early on, too, until I went back and started looking at history and the way we would present ourselves and the candidates would present themselves in our political history. It wasn't 24/7 media news cycles with the Internet and social media dominating the way it does now. But if you look at the political discourse and the cartoons, the political cartoons and campaign messages that go back decades in our cycle, in our political cycles. It's rough and tumble politics, and that generally happens in times when people are either feeling disconnected and, feeling both disconnected and not confident in the effectiveness of the country's management.
Well, we have to take a very short break talking about last night's Republican presidential debate. The voice you just heard is Alan Novak, former chair of the Pennsylvania Republican Party. He's an attorney, also serves as president of Novak Strategic Advisors. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Joe Watkins. He is a political commentator for MSNBC, served in the first Bush White House, and also joining us by telephone, Ben Domenech, publisher of The Federalist. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Getting three perspectives on last night's debate, and we want yours as well. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And stay with us. More clips after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and talking with Joe Watkins, Ben Domenech, and Alan Novak about last night's Republican presidential debate and the race for the White House among and between the Republicans. And you can call us, people are calling us, 1-888-477-9499. Joe, I understand the anger, and I think we actually did a show about this earlier this week, and I think we can all agree, everyone's angry about something. But what would a President Cruz or a President Trump or a President Rubio, what would they do about some of these issues that people care so deeply about and are so frustrated with?
Well, they've got to get elected first, of course.
I understand that.
That's no easy task with the Iowa caucuses coming, followed by New Hampshire and South Carolina. they've got to have serious ground game if they want to win. I mean, to translate those poll numbers into actual victories, you've got to have people that get your people to the polls or to the caucuses to support you. So that's no easy task. But that being said, anybody who's elected, whether the person's a Democrat or Republican, is going to have a lot of work to do to bring Americans back together again. I mean, we're pretty polarized as a country. And right now, people see the other side as their mortal enemy almost. It's going to take a lot of work to make Americans feel like, you know, we really are a country. And we're a diverse country with a lot of different understandings and perspectives and colors and ethnicities and religious backgrounds. And yet and still we're one. Mm. It's going to take a lot of work for anybody who's elected to bring us back together again. And that person's
so
going to have to.
Forget what I just said for the last, you know, 6 or 9 months?
Well, it's the same thing that President Obama talked about when he, in 2004 at the Democratic Convention, he talked about we're not a group of red and blue states, but we're the United States of America. But he's been unable to, during the term of his presidency, to really bring us together. And it's hard. The hard part becomes is that when people from the other side attack you, the tendency of any elected official is to attack back, to respond back. It's hard to absorb the blow, to resist the urge to attack back and to embrace and say, well, you know what, maybe you're right. How do we move forward together? You know, let's go to Camp David and spend some time together and figure this out and figure out where we move forward, how we move forward, how we mend our fences, and how we get things done.
Well, let me play a clip. I have two lined up at a clip. This was from last night's debate. Senator Marco Rubio criticizing Governor Chris Christie for holding certain positions. Let's give it a listen.
Unfortunately, Governor Christie has endorsed many of the ideas that Barack Obama supports, whether it's Common Core or gun control or the appointment of Sonia Sotomayor or the donation he made to Planned Parenthood. Our next president and our Republican nominee cannot be someone who supports those positions.
Ben, is he right?
You know, in a certain extent, I think he is. The thing that's interesting about Chris Christie in this race is that tonally, he actually is a better fit maybe for the Times than Marco Rubio. Rubio is kind of a sunny optimism type of candidate, where Christie is more pessimistic. They have very similar views when it comes to the types of approaches that they would have when it comes to policy. And yet the establishment of the Republican Party, the party elites, have been much more optimistic about Marco Rubio's chances than they have Chris Christie's, in part because he has a pretty negative personal rating with a lot of Republican voters. I think it will be interesting to see, though, whether that changes after New Hampshire, in the sense that Christie is doing well there. He's doing better there than he is elsewhere. And it's going to be interesting to see who kind of cracks the top three in New Hampshire from someone from the establishment lane. I think that that person who is that candidate, whether it's Christie, whether it's Rubio, whether it's Kasich, whether it's even Bush, is going to be the guy that that people really gamble on down the stretch to perhaps compete with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump.
Ben, we're going to call you back. Your phone line has a lot of pops and crackles on it, and I want to make sure our listeners can hear you loud and clear. So you hang up, and we will carry on the conversation. We'll call you back. Let me turn to you, Alan Novak. And Ben described Marco Rubio as a kind of sunny or sunnier candidate, perhaps, than Chris Christie. It didn't seem so sunny last night, I have to say. And everything was, you know, he led with Obama. You know, Obama is going to take – Obama secretly believes that he – or Obama secretly wants to take away all of your guns. Why do you think he focused so heavily on the president?
Because that's the one unifying factor among Republicans. The one thing that every Republican agrees on is that Barack Obama has not been a good president, and that electing Hillary Clinton or the next Democrat candidate, presumably Hillary Clinton, is another term of Barack Obama. So he's actually casting a line out there to say, look, this is the one thing we can all agree on, that we don't like where the president has taken the country. We don't like his policies, and we've got to stop it and turn it around. So I that's the way I interpreted his remarks. He's trying to get to that 80-20 principle. You know, if we disagree on 20% of the issues, but we agree 80% of the times, we can build a team around that 80% agreement. And he is more optimistic. He's more passionate. I mean, his passion converts to optimism easier than Donald Trump's. His passion converts to anger. Ted Cruz is obviously playing to the Tea Party base.
Well, let me play. This is Chris Christie, I guess, going back at Senator Marco Rubio, explaining the difference between a senator and a governor.
This is the difference between being a governor and being a senator. See, when you're a senator, what you get to do is just talk and talk and talk. And you talk so much that nobody can ever keep up with what you're saying is accurate or not. When you're a governor, you're held accountable for everything you do.
Is that a winning point of view, Joe Watkins?
Well, if you're a debate, it may be. I mean, all you want to do in these debates is try to move the numbers if you can. And I think Christie is working hard to do that. He's got, as I understand it, a very strong ground game in New Hampshire. Don't know what's going to happen in Iowa yet, other than the you've got Cruz and Trump obviously vying to win that contest. I don't know how well Christie does in Iowa. I know that if he does do well in New Hampshire, that he has that it makes him a serious contender in this race. So he's a smart guy. I think he's doing everything he can to try to move his numbers.
We did some fact-checking this morning or looking at the fact-checkers about what was said last night. And when Rubio said that Christie supported Sotomayor for the U.S. Supreme Court, Christie said, no. I'm just going to read a quote here. This is Christie on Sotomayor. I support her appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court and urge the Senate to keep politics out of the process and confirm her nomination, which I think also raises questions about these debates and the format. And this format last night, as I understood it, they had a little bit longer to describe their positions and go back and forth.
Fewer candidates, of course.
If you're a candidate, exactly. Although I think some people got more time than others. But at the same time, how do you – and it does raise questions for the host about fact-checking these. When a candidate says something that is a flat-out lie, how do you deal with that? I'm looking at you Joe, but Ben and Alan, I want you to get your response as well. I guess
Marnie,
this is Alan. Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, it's the next day. I mean, it's very difficult to check it in real time during a debate, particularly when by the time it's been checked, somebody else is talking about another issue. But it becomes something that will be used on the, you know, it'll become part of the storyline in the subsequent days to the debate. I'd like to go back to the governor situation.
Sure.
To show you how I was awful in this election, I thought governors were all going to have the advantage in this primary because that's where I come from. I want to see an executive track record for somebody who's going to be the chief executive officer of the country. But look how that's turned out. I think what Christie's trying to do is be the last governor standing, to Joe's point. I think he's trying to show well in New Hampshire, so he's the last governor in the mix with the businessman and the two senators.
There's certainly something
go
to
ahead,
that,
Dave.
To the
yeah,
extent
ahead.
That in the past, you know, you've seen chief executives emerge from various states to hold the presidency. I think this time around, what we've actually seen is that it's actually it helps you better to be a senator dealing with the national media on the national stage as opposed to being an executive who's been concentrating on your state. That's been Scott Walker's experience. It was Rick Perry's experience. It was Bobby Jindal's experience. I think it's been Jeb Bush's experience, where they've had to try to tell the story of what they were able to do in their state as opposed to telling a story about the stands that they took on a national stage related to national issues. And I think that's been a real shift in terms of what you've seen historically from both parties when it comes to the kind of experiences that prepare you for the office of the president.
Let me play another clip from last night. This is former Governor Jeb Bush, and he is responding to comments that Donald Trump made about Muslims and about immigration and refugees and how we should talk about them, how we should treat them. Let's give it a listen.
The Kurds are our strongest allies. They're Muslim. You're not going to even allow them to come to our country. The other Arab countries have a role to play in this. We cannot be the world's policeman. We can't do this unilaterally. We have to do this in unison with the Arab world. And sending that signal makes it impossible for us to be serious about taking out ISIS and restoring democracy in Syria.
So, Joe, people probably a year ago thought that this would be a shoo-in for Jeb Bush. Obviously, he is struggling. He can't seem to get above the single digits. He carved out this place for himself last night about Muslims and about immigrants. How do you see his candidacy? Where do you see it going?
Well, I think he's been very steady and very consistent. And, I'll make no bones about it. I mean, I worked for his father in the White House. My daughter worked for his brother in the White House. I supported him when he was a candidate for governor of Florida, and he won two terms there. I think he's a good candidate for president. He's had challenges in this cycle so far, but I think he's been very, very steady, very, very consistent. Passion sometimes wins more votes than reason, he has made a very reasonable case for a Middle East policy that going forward. In this day and age, with given the aura of terror, I mean, we just saw what happened yesterday in Indonesia. I mean, almost daily there's a report somewhere in the world about some terror event, and it's very, very real. I was in France when the events took place in Paris. I left that morning, Paris that morning, but it was very frightening, very scary. And so right now, candidates that speak to the fear and to the anger of Americans are likely to have more staying power.
Do you agree with that, Ben?
I do. I also think that Jeb Bush is a candidate who is essentially left politics right before some significant upheavals in terms of the coalition of the right, and has had struggles adapting to kind of the modern priorities, the post-Tea Party reality of the right. I don't think that there's really a path forward for him. And so the question really is, what point is there where he gets out? And at that point, does his voting base, the sort of 4 or 5% that he's got, accrue entirely to Marco Rubio, or does it accrue to a different candidate? Does it move in an interesting way? It's kind of similar to Ben Carson in the sense that, you know, if Ben Carson gets out after Iowa and endorses someone like Ted Cruz, it would be a significant move in the race, would send, you know, a significant portion of people in a certain direction. And with Jeb, I think the same factor is there. I don't think that he's going to be the nominee. There doesn't seem to be a very likely path for him to achieve that. But he could end up being a kingmaker in terms of determining who is the nominee.
You think he's just the wrong person at the wrong time for the Republican Party, Ben?
He really is. It's helpful to have him run, though, in the sense that the biggest question facing the Republican Party over the past several years has been, what did you learn from the George W. Bush years? What did you take away from the foreign policy decisions, the domestic policy decisions of the George W. Bush years? We've seen a little bit of working out of that when it comes to the argument that's been playing out between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio as it regards foreign policy. I think it's helpful to have Jeb Bush in the race, simply to have someone present who has a bit of a connection to those years and drives kind of a conversation about understanding those years. But it's simply not the case where this is a guy who fits with today's party. He is no longer connected to the voting base of this electorate. And it's changed so much since he was active in Republican politics. He was a very conservative governor. He was a very successful one. He would probably be a very good president from my perspective. But he was also somebody who is just disconnected with the priorities of the current electorate.
And he never looks like he's comfortable on the stage, I have to say, whatever that means. It just doesn't look like that's his venue.
Yeah. I agree with Ben on this. The game changed on Jeb Bush. He got out and he came back in, and it's a different game now. And he looks like a guy that doesn't have his fastball anymore.
Let me get some callers in, and we got a lot of comments as well. Let me get Paul from, looks like Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks very much. I'll try to make it real quick.
Sure.
I work in Philadelphia. And I look around, I can't look in any direction without seeing construction cranes putting up really big, new, expensive buildings. So the talk that I hear about the economy being in terrible shape and the country being in terrible shape, to me, is not true. Maybe it's true in Kentucky and Tennessee, and I've seen maps that show that most welfare and assistance of one kind or another actually does go to these red states. But in reality, it appears to me from our stock market and a lot of other indicators that the talk about America being in terrible shape economically isn't true. Just in general, it looked to me as though all of those candidates were trying to unite their base and their party around hatred of Barack Obama. And we've seen in history, I know people are sick of hearing about it, about regimes built on hatred but I think that's what I saw last night. And that's all I have to say.
Sure, Paul. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alan Paul is saying what he saw last night made him nervous and believing that the country might be better off than what the Republicans were saying last night.
Well, I think it comes down to who do you talk to, how confident do people feel. I don't think people feel confident. And frankly, today is not a good day to be talking about the stock market, or frankly, the last couple of weeks are a good day to be citing that as an indicator that things are going well. Because the arrows are all pointing down pretty drastically. But I think it's not a hatred of Barack Obama. It is a unification around changing the direction of his policies. Over-regulation and over-taxation. I think if there's one thing that can unite Republicans, it's that we're doing too much government regulation, too much taxation, and frankly, too much dependency on large, big federal government.
Joe,
if we get back to that, we get most of the candidates on the same page.
Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, as somebody who once worked in the financial markets, what I know is that the rate of unemployment is 5%. So speaking to the caller's earlier point, certainly from the standpoint of unemployment, it looks like the country's in better condition than it has been in the past. The reality,
certainly than 8 years ago.
That's correct. But you have to look at the other underlying data. Which shows that we have challenges. For instance, if you look at the long-term unemployment rate, again, that's about 25.7%, 25.7% of the unemployment rate. So more than a quarter of the people who are unemployed have been unemployed for a long time. The labor force participation rate tells you how many people who can work are actually participating in the labor force. That's down to late 1970s levels of when Carter was president, 62.6% at last check, which means that nearly 40% of people who can work aren't working. The number of part-time workers who are working part-time for economic reasons continues to grow. A month ago, it grew by over 300,000 new people. It remains at about over 6 million people working part-time for economic reasons. So these are people who are not happy. They do have a job, but they've lost their benefits. They're not happy, and they make up this sad tale of weakness in our economy going forward.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking about last night's Republican presidential debate, talking about the Republican Party as well. Three guests and lots of people that want to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Joe Watkins, a political commentator for MSNBC, Ben Domenech, a publisher for The Federalist, Alan Novak, former chairman of the Pennsylvania Republican Party. And again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read a bunch of tweets and emails here, and then we'll get some more callers in. Tweet from Walt, debate last night, all style, no substance, no policy proposals or solutions, gloom, doom, high school drama. Tweet from David, why is it that Cruz cares about the Constitution now but wants to hold retention elections for SCOTUS? Email from Chase, listening right now, and I wish you'd ask your guests whether they think this anger and disgust with government, where it comes from, Mitch McConnell's famous statement that they wanted to make Obama a one-term president. From Carol, unfortunately, Republican candidates are preaching fear and anger, which, of course, is spreading through the electorate. That's hardly what we need. And on and on and on, sort of tapping into what we've been talking about. Let me get Aubrey from Plowville, Pennsylvania. Aubrey, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm glad you could take my call. How
sure.
you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, Aubrey.
I'm his old college roommate from
Penn. Hey, Aubrey.
All right.
Aubrey Jarrett.
Hey, man.
Hey, man.
Yeah, man. How you been?
Great.
Hey, look, Joe and I have had, back in the day, many discussions, brief, about politics, and I'm proud of it. And that being said, my problem is what the email you got about Mitch McConnell. And that's like it envelops the whole last 7 years, the whole idea of non-cooperation. I mean, if the Republican parties were truly into inclusion, how come they didn't step up with voter registration? They tried to, like, cast it askance, ignore it when it was being done in Alabama when they were shutting down the voter registration places. How come they didn't do more support for the shovel-ready jobs on the stimulus package? How come they didn't do more for alternative energy? How come they didn't do more for the long-term unemployment rates? I'm telling you why I'm saying this. I've been out here 20-plus years. I worked on factory floors. I was promoted up into what you may call the executive sphere of my company. And these people are angry. I get that. But the thing is, no one is taking responsibility for the conditions that make them angry. And when you tell the country that you're not going to cooperate with the president and you're going to do everything to make him fail, you're telling you would make the country fail.
You know what, Aubrey, I got to jump in here, and I really appreciate you raising the points, and I would love to sit with you and Joe Watkins and listen to you go back and forth.
Oh my God.
But this is a radio show. I hate to jump in here, but
that's a 2-day show.
That's right.
Exactly. I get it. Let me give Joe just a quick response, and then perhaps Alan and Ben want to weigh in on this as well, and I'll get some more callers in.
Aubrey makes good points. The party, in my estimation, is not where it wants to be going forward. I mean, we've got to continue to adjust to be a party that meets the needs of the 21st century United States of America. And if we're going to be a bigger tent, we've got to do a better job at reaching out to everybody who agrees with us and who wants to be a part of us. So we've got work to do, no doubt about it.
Ben, I've interviewed a number of economists, and one of the questions I've asked them is, in terms of our struggling economy, how much responsibility does Congress bear for that, whether it's a government shutdown and the things that Congress has done? And they all have said they bear some responsibility for this. Can you speak to that?
Well, I think going back to what the caller had to say, elected politicians represent the people who elected them. And the people who elected the Republican Congress wanted to do so to essentially have someone as a block for President Obama's agenda. I think one of the things that's been most interesting over the course of the past couple of years has been the thesis on the part of the Obama administration that essentially through redistribution and through the spread of benefits that they would be able to bring in a new group of voters to the Democratic Party, people who would have a vested interest in the maintenance of those types of benefits, particularly through the focus of Obamacare. And what we've seen is that hasn't happened at all. In Kentucky, for example, where Matt Bevin was just elected the governor, there were counties that had seen dramatic increases in people on government assistance, people on Medicaid, under the expansion of Obamacare. Those counties went enthusiastically for the conservative candidate who wanted to cut off those benefits. And I think that that's kind of an indication of what's playing out here in the Republican coalition right now, where you have someone like Donald Trump appealing to these disaffected working class voters. Basically, people who are saying, I may be signing up for these benefits, but I still don't think they're good enough in terms of the big scheme of things. Mm. And I think that that's a very interesting phenomenon in terms of the expectations that have been here, within both the Republican and the Democratic coalition. Republicans had expected as well that these voters would be people who, once they got those benefits, would be invested in their furtherance. I think that that's actually not playing out the way that people expected. That's a very interesting phenomenon.
It sure is. Alan, I have a comment from Jim who says, I think Rand Paul is a real contender and should have been on the debate stage last night. I think he'd be a better president than the others on the stage. He's less excitable / insane than the others on the stage. Did you miss Rand Paul last night?
No. He doesn't have the numbers. I think there has to be fewer, not more. So, no, I didn't miss him. And frankly, the one thing polls are helpful for is gauging whether you're connecting or not. Those numbers mean something, even if it's only what it means for today.
Does Iowa really matter in the big scheme of things? I'm looking at you, Joe Watkins.
Yeah. Well, it's important.
It's a caucus. I mean, for one thing.
Well, the reality is that we've had Iowa caucus winners who have not been the party's nominee in a number of cycles, and so from that standpoint, whoever wins the Iowa caucuses on February 1st may not necessarily be the party nominee. That being said, New Hampshire has been, I guess, more of a measure of who the party's nominee will be. Although the party's nominee has not always been the New Hampshire winner. Clearly, New Hampshire gives you momentum heading into New Hampshire. I'm sorry, Iowa gives you momentum heading into New Hampshire. I mean, to win the Iowa caucuses gives you a head of steam heading into New Hampshire. You don't have a lot of time to translate the ground game in Iowa to New Hampshire, but if you've got ground game in Iowa and New Hampshire, and you do well in Iowa, that can help you greatly in New Hampshire. And then there's South Carolina coming right behind it in Super Tuesday. So you've got to have money in mm-hmm. order to have staff in all those places who are actively asking your people to show up because you need them to show up in order to vote for you. It's quite an undertaking.
Let me see what Lucas from Nashville has to say. Lucas, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to mirror your commenter from Philadelphia's comments and say that Nashville, Tennessee skyline looks very similar right now. Lots of planes, lots of construction. And I also wanted to add that a lot of Nashville's success in the past 10 years has come from the influx of immigrants into that city.
And I think there are a number of cities could probably say some of the same thing. Ben, the whole issue of immigration came up kind of late in the debate last night, focused mm-hmm. largely on Rubio, which is a sort of complex series of positions that he has taken. But how much
to
say
the least.
How much do you think, though, immigration will play out this year in the Republican Party?
You know, immigration has had an enormous impact on this election, and it's interesting because, you know, the reality is that the elites of both the Republican and the Democratic Party are essentially agreed on the point of immigration. They're not that far apart. Paul Ryan is not holding a position that's that different from Nancy Pelosi when it comes to immigration. It's simply a situation, I think, where Donald Trump recognized that there's about a quarter of the nation, when you look at these various polls, that actually really wants to deport people who are here illegally, and that view is not espoused in any significant way by the leadership of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And I think that he saw that, recognized it, and decided to exploit it. The immigration issue this time around is certainly helping Donald Trump and Ted Cruz in terms of their early argument. But it will be interesting to see how they shift potentially when it comes to a general election. I don't know the views of the other guests that you have on. My own view, though, is that at this point in this election, after so many months of a very consistent, steady leadership on the part of Donald Trump, essentially the Republican Party and their elites need to get around to the idea that perhaps the only way to prevent him from being the nominee is to basically decide on accepting the idea of someone like Ted Cruz, who is perhaps disliked by a lot of the party elites, disliked by the party leadership, certainly in Washington, but is also someone who is more acceptable as a nominee than potentially someone like Donald Trump.
Do you see it that way, Alan?
I do. I actually do. Immigration is a wedge issue in the Republican Party that's pretty significant right now. And I think we need to figure that out. The Republican Party needs to figure that out. My concern about the way immigration is posed, and Donald Trump has done it very well, is he's made it a zero-sum game. Where I've always looked at immigration, it's something that can be done responsibly, it can be managed. You can have secure borders, you can have documentation, and you can have a workforce. And you can have people coming here because they want to be here. And you can keep people out of here who shouldn't be here. It's always been posed as you can't have one without the other.
Well, there's nothing to say that Donald Trump won't eventually get to that point, Alan. I think that we've seen with most politicians and with a number of elected officials that their perspectives on issues can evolve.
You could see Donald Trump evolving on.
I think that a smart candidate like Donald Trump knows what he needs to say in order to move the numbers, and to move the numbers now. And all you have is now. You don't have the guarantee of tomorrow. You don't get to play tomorrow if you don't have numbers today. And so he's a very smart candidate. He knows how to get the attention of the voters and how to keep that attention in a crowded field.
But I'm just imagining if I were a supporter of Donald Trump and he, yeah. for all the reasons that he has put out there,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden he begins to moderate on that, I'm going to be really angry at him.
I would just say it depends on who your audience is. I mean, right now you're talking about a primary audience. You've got to win Iowa first. You've got to win New Hampshire second. You've got to win South Carolina third. Those are your audiences right now. And then there's the general election audience if you end up being the party's nominee. That's a very different audience, a much broader audience than your initial audience. And you've got to say things that certainly your poll numbers will tell you right away where you stand with the general election audience, and you've got to do things to move numbers so that you pass muster with them.
Let me get looks like Julian from Norristown to join our conversation. Hi, Julian. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I kind of wanted to say something that hasn't really come up yet, but of how Ted Cruz especially, now obviously Donald Trump has gotten a lot of flack for some of his more dubious borderline racist comments, but Ted Cruz actually, and I believe it was also Bobby Jindal was involved in this event, went up on stage with a Christian cleric, shall we say, who essentially proposed outlawing homosexuality and, you know, going back to quote-unquote biblical law, and that kind of, that's really extreme bigotry going on there. I mean, implicit endorsement of it. And also looking at some of the other stuff he said, it's playing to a very extreme segment of the population, and I find it deeply worrying.
Julian, let me see what – oh, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ben, do you want to weigh in on that?
You know, it's one of these things that I think always kind of comes up whenever, you know, there's an election where, you know, you're on stage with people and you're associated with people. I don't know exactly the situation that he's talking about in this context. One thing that I think is interesting is, and John Ward for Yahoo Politics has written about this a couple of times, there is an interesting contrast between the evangelical support that Ted Cruz has been able to tap into and the support that Marco Rubio has tapped into. The support that Rubio has received has been kind of younger, hipper, more in touch kind of members of the evangelical community, people like Tim Keller from New York City and people like of that nature, while Ted Cruz has really tapped into kind of the old guard, moral majority kind of population that feels like it's lost a real grip on the culture over the course of the past several decades. It's a very interesting contrast in terms of the types of Christian support that they're receiving this cycle, and it gives you kind of a perspective on the differences in terms of what you're seeing within the Christian community over the course of the past several decades.
We're almost out of time here. An email from Greg. He says, if the country is really in such bad shape and has such poor leadership, can the guests name some countries they think that are in better shape and are better led? I'm looking to Joe Watkins. And what the president said was on Tuesday night was kind of compared to the rest of the world, we're doing better.
I've traveled a bit around the world, and so I've had a chance at least to look at the United States comparatively. And I love being an American. I love living in the United States. I choose to live here, and this is my home. I think this is the greatest country in the world. Doesn't mean that there aren't things that we can do to make it better. Doesn't mean that we are not in need of change. Doesn't mean that we have a distance yet to travel in terms of learning to love each other despite our differences. All those things are true about America, but I can think of no better place than this.
How about for you, Alan? Is there a better country out there?
No, we're the best country. We have the best country to live in and the best system of government, but we can always do better. And we can always be managed better, and we can always lead better. And I think that's the difference. It's not that America is bad, frankly, and you see this going on in Europe. There's lots of conservative movement in Europe, across the European spectrum. But we can always do better, and I think that's the point. And that's kind of why Ronald Reagan was my hero, because that was his approach. We can always do better.
How about for you, Ben? Do you like America?
I love America. It is my home. But I will say this. There is a situation right now in the American political system which I think could be leading us down the road toward looking a lot more like Europe. It's actually kind of an exception to the rule to have a coalition on the right that is classically liberal in a sense, that believes in free markets and freedom for all people, as opposed to simply serving the demands of identity politics. In Europe, you see these kind of populist identity politics movements that are anti-immigrant, that are anti-free trade, anti-free market. And I think that unfortunately for the American system, we're seeing a movement toward that right now within the Republican Party that could be transformational in the long term.
On that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ben Domenech, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Alan Novak, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Joe Watkins, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program and stay with us. We'll be right back.